So like we think about immigration at the border and we're like, okay, well, what does intersectional environmentalism have to do with immigration at the border? Well, climate migration is because disasters are starting to be exacerbated by the climate. People are going to continue to be displaced as resources become more quote unquote scarce because of the ways that we inequitably distribute resources. You could even, as one example, tie it back to an issue like immigration.
Our guest today, Deandra Maricet Esparza, is the co-founder of Intersectional Environmentalist. She's got some amazing views and is leading the charge on how we interact with our world and has been recognized globally for her efforts. Join us today on Unique Genius, the business of creators, where we dive in and learn more about the business of some of the most successful creators out there.
So intersectionality is a framework that was actually born out of the legal context.
Okay.
Have you heard of this?
No.
No?
No?
Yeah.
Okay. So it was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, who's a Black feminist scholar, batty professor, comes from the legal space. And there's a great TED Talk that she has online where she, I think it's like 15 minutes. It's worth a listen. Mm-hmm. And she basically was explaining this being one of many examples as to why she coined the term. So she was on a case where she was... She knew that there was discrimination happening at the intersection of two identities that Black women were facing in the workplace. So she was on a case where this woman was saying, hey, I think I'm being discriminated against and not being hired in this workplace, like on the basis of discrimination. And the way that they were kind of getting away with it at the beginning was by saying, well, that's not true because we do have women in our workplace and we also have Black men. And what she found was that, well, based on the roles that are in this workplace, Kimberly Crenshaw was able to conclude or help her client conclude that the workplace was discriminating against her on the basis of her specifically being a Black woman.
So the intersection.
So the intersection of those identities. Yes, absolutely. Huh. And so that, and in conjunction with so many other examples, led to the coining of this term. And so
that's
since
intersectional.
Intersectionality.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
So what it does is it suggests that we all have these overlapping identities that can create, just out of the systems that we were born into, can create these overlapping conditions for either advantage or disadvantage.
Right.
Right. So like if I walk into some type of workplace, it might be a disadvantage if I have a disability, or it might be an advantage if I have a particular income level, things like that. So all of these identities and the way that they overlap, that's intersectionality. And since the coining of that term, it has been applied to all different kinds of social movements to broaden the way that we talk about them. So, for example, the one that I think is the most well-known, at least prior to the founding of like my organization and the uprising of the Black Lives Matter movement in 2020, was its application to the feminist movement. Mm-hmm. So when the feminist movement, there were like many, many waves of the feminist movement. And when it started, there was this huge criticism that a lot of white women had that capacity socially to lead the feminist movement in a way that wasn't properly serving women of color, in a way that wasn't serving queer women, gender expansive folks. And so that's when people started arguing that if we actually want to have effective feminist movements, which liberates everyone, we need to apply an intersectional lens to the way we're addressing the problem and not just let white women like lead the charge, because they, while they have valid criticisms to bring to the table, they can't represent everybody because they don't hold everyone's identity. So the feminist movement was a really great like initial space to apply intersectionality outside of the legal context.
Right.
And in 2020, my organization, thanks to our founder, we were able to really help the environmental movement solidify the application of intersectionality to the movement outside of the legal context.
So where is the intersectional environmentalism come in?
So,
or the concept of intersectional?
There are so many. I would say that generally the birth of... So when people think environmentalism, a huge thing that they think about is conservation. And what we don't know and what a lot of academic spaces don't teach us is that conservation was born out of colonization. And that when we had indigenous communities here overseeing land, that was heavily disrupted by settler colonialism that created things that a lot of us really enjoy today, like national parks. Right. So there's so much nuance around the way that we enjoy our environment today, but also don't really have a capacity to see with the current frameworks that we have. how those systems were built and some of the harms that they perpetuate. So when I think of Indigenous communities, for example, oftentimes Indigenous communities, relative to wherever they are in the world, might not have access because of the way we approach conservation through a Western settler colonial lens. They might not have access to sacred sites. They might not have access to places where they have grown traditional foods. And a lot of those things are connected to cultures that preserve our environments. So when we disrupt that, we're ultimately disrupting the best stewards we have of the environment. And so what this creates is this opportunity to, sure, maybe say, okay, conservation has provided us with all of these wonderful elements of environmentalism. Like, we get to go hiking, we get to go to national parks, and we love this. But if we apply an intersectional lens, which really takes into account those who have been most harmed by the environmental systems we have, how does that actually help us expand our notions of environmentalism and what stewardship should look like?
So that's things like, we're creating a national park here, but that limits access to a sacred site, a burial site, a place like that for a community that was protecting it long before we even needed the concept of conservation.
And what implications does that have for what ownership should look like in that context? So how do we maybe create places where people can go and protect and enjoy protected land? But what does it look like for ownership to be shared? So, like, talking about Indigenous sovereignty and things like that, which our government, I think, still really, really struggles to, like I mentioned yesterday, federally recognize certain tribes, which grants them access to that power and that sovereignty. So that's something that is, I think, a really big, like, criticism for the conservation space specifically, but there are so many ways to apply that to, I mean, you could talk about conservation spaces, which are, like, I think, more traditional environmentalism topics, but you can even take it to, like, outdoor retailers and companies and the stories that they've perpetuated through their branding and marketing, not with any ill will, but what is the natural result of years and years and years of marketing and storytelling that suggests you have to be this, like, super athletic, tall, handsome white man to be deemed an outdoorsman. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of different ways that you can kind of pick it apart. But now that we have this intersectional lens, I think it helps us more meaningfully pick apart all of the ways that these areas and these forms of environmentalism can improve.
And I know where I'm from in Canada, that definitely in a lot of ways, if you're looking to say, put in a road through an area, usually the first step is actually, and the biggest hurdle is going through the Indigenous band. And they actually have a lot of the approval process. If it doesn't go through them, you're not going to the province or the district or anything to get approval for it. And they're actually much better equipped to look at, you know, environmental impact and do we want this here and is this okay? So it's still not perfect by any stretch, but it's a step.
No, absolutely. None of it's perfect, but I think even even the adoption of the language, it's not so solid in that, okay, now, you know, bad players aren't going to get away with anything, right? Fossil fuel executives are still getting their projects passed, right, by, like, this presidential body. And so I think it's not necessarily, like, the ultimate weapon, but I think what this language, like, an intersectional environmentalism, it's really created a social form of accountability. So it's really hard, I think, if you are a big player in the environmental space now with the awareness that's out there, it's a little bit harder to get away with your constituents or your stakeholders or your followers or your community to not have a better sense of the harm that you might be perpetuating. And it's created this really healthy conflict that we're still very much, like, at the genesis of, which I think is good for the movement in the long term.
And do you think there's a difference of, let's see, view of timelines? Like, if you're talking to a politician, they probably have a 4-year timeline, 3-year, 4-year, 8-year, and possibly self-interested.
Oh, of course. Whereas, win that election.
Whereas if you're talking to a band, you may be looking at a multi-generational timeline, or at least hopefully. But often there's a multi-generational view, and I believe it's more you're dealing with a community or a council of elders as opposed to an individual politician can, with the stroke of a pen, make a decision that gets them the next election or gives them a job after they come out of politics.
No, I think intergenerational relations has been such an interesting, especially as somebody who oversees, like, a social media platform. Let me know if this is not where you were taking this, but what that sparks for me is how interesting intergenerational relations have been and the implications for that in this space. Because on TikTok and on, like, all these social media platforms, you have young people just like bashing boomers left and right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe for good reason in a lot of ways, but what is lost in that as well? And I think that for me and what I've learned, even as like a young executive director, a first-time executive director, how critical it has been to be able to not only preserve a reverence for the elders in our spaces, but also to maintain an understanding and a capacity for that relationship building and navigating, particularly when the quote-unquote elders or just people from older generations aren't on your side, mm-hmm. and being able to come to the table with them. So that's something that I think social media and like the Gen Z rise of criticisms of boomers mm-hmm. has broken down a little bit, but I think that needed to happen. I just think that there is also a lot of evidence that with that breaking down needs to be this emergence of like, or revitalization of our capacity to like come together. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One place in reading a little bit about you and the work you're doing that my mind went in talking intersectionalism and some of the things, the concepts, and I'm really curious if this is even included within it, is some of the differing impacts on different communities from changes in the environment. Is that a piece within this, or is that a separate
concept? Oh, yeah, 100%. Like, yeah. So tell me if this is where you were heading. That makes me think of like climate migration. So like we think about immigration at the border and we're like, okay, well, what does intersectional environmentalism have to do with immigration at the border? Well, climate migration is because disasters are starting to be exacerbated by the climate. People are going to continue to be displaced as resources become more quote unquote scarce because of the ways that we inequitably distribute resources. I mean, we're seeing right now in international news that there's a huge threat of thousands and thousands of people being displaced. And a lot of this is, you could tie to capitalism, you could tie it to control over oil and gas, you could tie it to so many things, but it all comes down to capitalism and our, not to be like that's a broad stroke, right? Mm-hmm. But when we look at the ways in which we've set up our economic systems and how that ties back to the exacerbation and creation of climate change and the impacts that it has on people, you could even, as one example, tie it back to an issue like immigration.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I was thinking things like, you know, if you're in Haiti, you might be more likely to be impacted by environmental
100%. Right. And more importantly, tying it back to environmental justice, environmental degradation that your people didn't necessarily cause.
Right.
And that's what's really important. Yeah.
And that's such a difficult thing because you can't just decide, oh, we're going to clean up our island and then everything is fine.
You're
more impacted by what the rest of the world is doing than...
100%. Yeah. And I think that even though like the policy space is not one at all that I'm an expert in, what I have taken and like me and my pals who started intersectional environmentalism, the organization, what we take a lot of interest in is the narrative healing and the rhetoric work around issues like that. So making sure that, okay, in your example, right, you have particularly coastal communities. I love that that's like where your mind went. Like when it comes to coastal communities, I think it's really important that people have the resources that they need to understand that this isn't like a cultural issue of these people that they're encountering these environmental issues and can't, you know, muster the communal reaction or response to be able to handle it. I mean, these are, when you consider all the barriers that are in place, how can we equip people with the resources that they need to understand like, hey, actually, the reason why some people are doing okay in the midst of the climate crisis and some are not is because we have very different positionalities within the systems that we've created. And some people are really set up to face the climate crisis a lot later because we're all going to face it. But some people are set up to face it a lot later. And some people are set up, unfortunately, to face it a lot sooner. And not everybody has the resources to be able to handle that. So I think what I hope is an outcome of our work is that when people read our resources, they recognize that like, oh, I see that it's not like an issue of culture. I see it's not an issue of people, but it is systemic, right? Because when you look like pre-colonial settlement in the U.S., these issues weren't present. Like the environment was very, people and the environment were very much coexisting in harmony. And I think that's relevant in a lot of our cultural backgrounds, right? Where we all come from. But how have we structured systems in a way that really have like broken that relationship?
Thank you.
I am curious how you came to this. So what's the why for you? What's the journey from, you know, start in childhood or where does this begin for you and why?
Yeah. I think there's lots of beginnings, but I think the more immediate one prior to the founding of the organization, I was in the fashion industry. Mm-hmm. And if my outfit didn't give it away, no, I was in the fashion industry. And I think that like anybody entering that space, I had a very romantic view of what mm-hmm. that would mean, what it would be like. And certainly it was romantic. I had a great time. I lived in New York. I was the first one in my family to move away. And it was just this wonderful time. Mm-hmm. And I think I entered that space with unknowingly with my own cultural reverence for what fashion can do for a people, for culture. And I've learned a lot about fashion being used in movements of change. And I mean, it is a tool of expression. And so you can use it in all these different art forms. And I really entered with that mindset, but was placed in on a buying team where I basically served as like a trend analyst, right, which was really interesting. I was like, is this what I want to do? I don't know. But I ended up really enjoying it. But the side that I did not enjoy about it was being, and this was kind of at the, as I was in this role, because I was very entry level, right? I had just graduated from school. I was also simultaneously learning about a lot of social justice issues as it relates to supply chain, not just in fashion, but just retail and consumerism in general, right? Or manufacturing and production. And I also started learning about not only directly the social justice issues within supply chains and like humanitarian issues, but also what happens to society when cultural reverence is broken down. So I worked for, I won't name names, but I worked for a brand that was very well known for novelty. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily think that it's inherently negative to find a little bit of whimsy and novelty out of like cultural symbols and elements, but I think when it is connected to, which certainly is not limited to this brand that I worked for, it's just the fashion industry as a whole.
Yep.
When novelty is connected to a system that really degrades the purveyors of that culture, is that ultimately a good expression of fashion? Is that a good expression of business? Is that a good expression of the systems that we create in the world? Because ultimately, fashion is meant to purvey art. And is that art, right, when it's connected to systems like that? And so I became very quickly disenchanted with the fashion industry, just learning all of that. And I think that it culturally, it ended up disrupting so much of the vision I had for it that I ended up with no plan at all.
Yeah.
Quitting completely and moving back home to completely reevaluate, because it wasn't just that company I wanted to leave. It was the industry that I had spent years preparing myself for. So I was like, well, shit, what do I do? Well, can I cuss? Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
So I was like, well, shit, what do? I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
So I quit and I went home to reevaluate life, my relationship to what I had prided myself on, which was wanting to be one of the first like women business entrepreneurs in my family. Mm-hmm. And I really prided myself on that. And so I was crushed. I was devastated. I was like, okay, this industry, like I could stay in it, but like my gut wrenches every day. Like I have mm-hmm. to leave. And not to mention even the environmental impacts that I was facing. So I would be in rooms where we were literally calculating how many units we had projected to burn, just like burning off inventory. I'm like, this isn't sustainable. This isn't how people have traditionally created offerings. Everything that we create, even in the tech space, everything is an offering to society. And I was like, this isn't an offering to the world. Like I just couldn't. And so I quit. I went home and then the lockdown happened, quarantine, pandemic.
Where's home for you?
Home is Texas.
Okay.
Yeah. I grew up in the Southwest.
Yeah. And it was interesting. You said you wanted to be the first female entrepreneur in coming from your family, first 100%. To move away. So you came home and then exploration of lockdown hits. How do you then?
Yeah. Exploration, lockdown hits. I am quite an introvert. And so I do hate to say that I thrived in quarantine mm-hmm. a little bit. You know, I think that it was a great, even though it was like a devastating for the world, mm-hmm. it was a great time to be alone, to heal, to be with my family, to bring all the cool stuff that I was learning about the world back home. And I think it was a great time to just reimagine the mechanisms with which I would align myself mm-hmm. with career. And that was really interesting. I had a blog at the time mm-hmm. That no one read. It was pretty cute, though, and no one was reading it. No, it was a blog that was not only helping me grapple with some of the things I was facing, mm-hmm. but, you know, close friends, too. So something that was a gift to me while I was in New York, because I'm such a, like, I loved building community in New York. I moved mm-hmm. there and knew, like, no one. So mm-hmm. I had to build community on my own. And what I found was all these people that were maybe in the agriculture space or the tech space or the beauty space or the fashion space. I mean, New York has everything, right? Finance space, like, what you name it, whatever space it was. I met all these really cool people that felt similarly to me in that it was really hard to talk about social justice in the context of these spaces. And so I launched this blog that was like, hey, what does it actually mean to approach holistic sustainability? Not that I was a pro by any mm-hmm. means at the time, but I was just grappling with the questions, right? It was just the questions I was grappling with. What does it mean to do this in the context of these different areas? And when the organization was founded, I'm jumping a little bit, but mm-hmm. when the organization was founded, my little blog that no one was reading
yeah.
ended up being kind of the framework that I used to like flip it into a new blog mm-hmm. that ended up supporting like the founding of our organization.
Great.
And then more people read that one.
Okay. Yeah. And that in doing that, that sort of, it sounds like it's an exploration of your values too.
100%.
To some extent.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because we often talk about like, it, you know, in my business, talk about core values as something in terms of decisions we make, people we hire, even, you know, relates to firing and promotion and opportunity and all of these things.
Yeah.
But
tough stuff.
You've got an interesting approach of like, you actually started that with yourself of like, you know, I'm firing myself.
Fire
this whole industry, everything
myself.
I train for.
Yeah.
Just based on values. That's how important they are. How do the values that you built there through the blog and self-exploration apply or within the organization?
I don't know that I've ever considered this pointedly a value, mm-hmm. but one of the things that I really appreciated about my journey was, again, taking that experience of me and all my friends in our spaces, finding it really difficult to talk about social justice issues. What I found was a sense of freedom in finding really incredible people that have been advocating more successfully than I had mm-hmm. and that like my friends had and my peers had for years, and recognizing how clearly disconnected we each were
right.
to those people. And to find those people in the fashion space and in like tangential spaces that I really, or adjacent spaces that I really liked, it empowered me so much and it gave me such a freedom because it's a sign that some of the path was forged, right? I don't have to come up with the frameworks. I don't have to come up myself and fight for all of the arguments behind why we shouldn't build oppressive systems. Like that work has not largely been completed, but mm-hmm. so much of it has already, like the groundwork has been laid.
Right.
And I think that being able to serve as a bridge mm-hmm. between the issues that plague us, right, that keep mm-hmm. us up, our 2 a.m. thoughts, right, the issues that plague us, and the people that have done so much work with their own 2 a.m. thoughts that, you know, connect with ours, I think that that was really powerful. And that is definitely something that I've shared with the other people on the IE team and something that we've embedded into the model of how we operate. So everything that we do is to make sure that we are serving as a bridge and a connector between people that are really passionate, seeking guidance or want to get involved and are us answering the questions, how can we connect these people with the incredible people who have been fighting in their space mm-hmm. that they can turn to and learn from, whether they're past, present, or emerging? And what are the local grassroots environmental efforts that are happening in their local towns? And how can we create educational resources that help bridge people, like really encourage people to go get involved, not with us, like yeah. we're not doing anything but amplifying them.
Right.
So how can we encourage people to get involved mm-hmm. with those organizations? Because that's what brought me a lot of peace in my own journey was coming face to face with issues I didn't know how to answer and then finding the people with the answers.
So how do you perform that? How do you do that bridge? So you got someone who's, say, in the finance industry in New York.
Yeah.
They're up at night thinking about this. They want to be a part of it. They don't know what to do.
Yeah.
You don't have to build all of the, say, content or ideas or solutions, frameworks.
No. Nope.
There are partners out there with you. Is that a partnership? How do you like connect that bridge between the two?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways. So one of my favorite styles of content that we create, whether it's in the form of a podcast or an infographic or like a toolkit, like a more formal expanded digital toolkit, I love being able to, mostly because I like to nerd out too, but I love being able to provide people with like a brief context. So it's like, okay, in the finance space, I'm not a finance pro, but in the finance space, let's say here's a brief context of how the finance space has been set up in such a way that's creating these inequities. Here are the people, because within that context, you almost have no choice. It's definitely our goal, but you almost have no choice but to say, here are the thought leaders that have been able to map out those inequities and really place terminology to the things and like build the frameworks and the tools that we get to use today to even assess that.
Right.
So we're giving that brief context and then, you know, giving flowers to the people that helped us gain that understanding. Because if you can't name it, you can't change it. So really recognizing and acknowledging those people. And then also simultaneously talking about, because we always want to come from a place of agency, right? Like communities oftentimes, maybe if they don't have resources, they certainly are, I think, out of proximity to the pains and the tensions of systems. They hold the solutions. They know what needs to change, but they need the resources. So by setting up that context, we're then able to say, and now here's what people are doing about it.
Right.
And here are the organizations that you can get involved with. Here are the authors that you can learn from. So in the finance context in particular, I'll recommend The Black Agenda. Wonderful book. Wonderful book. I'm not at all a finance pro, but I even personally found that book really accessible. And it completely opened my mind to all of the inequities that are shaped, not even just in the finance space, but in the medical space, et cetera. I think that is ultimately the goal, right? Is to say, hey, like one, maybe you were fed a narrative that suggests your people have no place in this because the environmental movement or maybe certain industries that are very white led, that's all you see. But actually here are people who have incredible legacies in this space and have been really successfully fighting for change in these spaces. So empowering people with that context and then showing them who is continuing that work now so that they can feel empowered to get involved and to do so in such a way that's not alone.
And I know you made some shifts in the business model from early on. So can you walk
so
us through
many.
A little bit of
how,
that?
Yeah, how many of them do you want me to walk through?
Well, some of that evolution and why?
Yeah, the business model has changed so much. So most people know us as a nonprofit. We didn't start off that way. I don't have a nonprofit background at all. And it's funny when people say that, like, oh, like nonprofit management and background. Like, I also don't really care to have one.
Right.
I had come from the business background. I have a sales background. And so our business model initially, also because the founder and I had deep ties in the retail space, we largely started off funding ourselves through partnerships. So partners that were coming to the table, maybe they were in the fashion space, outdoor space, whatever it may be. And they're saying, hey, we want to support what you're doing. We want to help create resources in such a way that it's relevant not only to your community, but to ours, so that this partnership can co-educate, you know, the people that you're supporting, but also the thousands, potentially millions of customers that we have. And so being able to drive our first few years just with media partnerships in that way was really, really great because it was a world that the founder and myself and a lot of the people that contributed to our platform had been criticizing for a long time. That's just what came naturally to us. So we didn't ask the question, you know, like, how do we become the best nonprofit ever? How do we get donations? How do we la la la? Not to discredit that in any way, but we leaned into what we were good at, right? We were largely people that were changing narrative and communications.
Yeah.
So who better than to, in the context of the environmental movement, partner with the people who were largely for decades now controlling the narrative of the environmental movement to the everyday person, and that being like outdoor retailers and brands.
So through these partnerships, is that driving exposure or revenue or both? Or what was the...
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, unfortunately, in... And not to disparage brands in any way or like the people behind brand teams, but I think this is just largely a reflection of how partnerships have often worked with grassroots environmental justice efforts. I think there's this assumption that grassroots activism doesn't make a lot of money and you don't need to pay them a lot of money. And because we, which just perpetuates that they don't have a lot of money.
Right.
So, and so when we were very fortunate to be gaining the virality that we were gaining because of the messaging from our founder, it did put us in a little bit of a position of power. And so we were able to say, hey, we really appreciate what we can create collectively. And then in the back of our minds, of course, we're thinking, but you're also gaining a tremendous amount of credibility by working with us. Right. So get ready to triple the price.
Right.
And so we worked with brands in that capacity. And of course, you know, there's obviously the assessment of how big of a brand are you?
Yeah.
We're not like gouging small brands, right?
Yeah.
But there was like that healthy assessment based on who was coming to the table. And that created space for us to have a business model that fed back into our community. So I think even in our first year, people talk about how important 1% for the planet is, and I'm a huge fan of the 1% for the planet team, but even through our community-driven model, more than 10% of our expenses went back into community members that were able to work and contribute to our platform, as opposed to it just being within the team.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think that it created... That space created a lot of room for us to like wield that power. And I think that that's not often an opportunity that grassroots environmental justice efforts get.
Yeah. Yeah. I think even just for any entrepreneurs and founders, that confidence, I mean, you've talked about this recently around that confidence to charge what you're worth and thinking through how you arrived there.
Yeah. And we certainly have grappled with that. Like we haven't walked away from every partnership feeling like we really got what we needed, but plenty of them we have. And I think that's because we were willing to face that tension, right? Are we going to just walk away from this huge Fortune 500 company and they're going to pay us like $1,000? You know what I mean? So we've certainly grappled with it, but I think in being willing to face that tension and like the scary, you know, hey, they might back out if we, it was really scary at times, but we also were very fortunate to have well-resourced partners come to us with people on the inside that also already understood that dynamic.
Right.
And so they were able to be really supportive as well. So yeah, I think it was us having a very strategic sense of how to navigate that situation, but we also were very fortunate and privileged to have really incredible people come to our table.
But and so in this process, you made the shift from profit to not-for-profit?
We did eventually.
Why the switch there?
So I think what ended up happening was we were doing really well. It certainly wasn't slowing down. We were doing well with partnerships. I also launched a consulting arm, which was really great within our organization. And all of that was very much within my comfort zone in terms of like it being inherently like business sales, like that world was just what was most comfortable to me. And we realized because of our size, because of our, you know, quote unquote influence or power, we had had a lot of really beautiful success being able to redistribute funding to our community. And most of it was by just including other people. So like making them contractors and like basically having them as contributors to our platform. But we started to slowly realize like, oh, we can actually serve as not only a bridge for people from a resource standpoint, educationally, but like financially too. And a lot of the reason for that was that so many organizations, this will change over time, but at least for right now, there are still so many organizations that or large companies, I should say, rather, they want to get involved. Maybe they're in the energy space, the fashion space, the ag space, whatever it may be. They want to support local grassroots efforts, but they don't have necessarily team members that are on the ground to know who those people are. And so we've had so many people come to us and say, hey, we want to give away $50,000 next year for Earth Month to organizations that, you know, are aligned with the work that we do, but are doing so at that grassroots level. Like we want to show that commitment, but we don't know who to give the funding to. So we were like, oh, okay, well, maybe we should become a nonprofit.
And that allows you to give more.
That allows us to almost serve in one way as like a foundation.
Interesting. So it was more about the outflow of funds than the inflow, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think there's obviously the 501c3 tax incentive for folks to give us that funding, which I think in the beginning was not an issue, mm-hmm. but over time maybe would have been.
Right.
Because there's the reality that intersectional environmentalism was really trendy from 2020 to 2023 to now. Mm. And there is the reality, if history repeats itself, that will start to dwindle if we don't keep the momentum up.
Right.
Which has serious implications for humanity. So
yeah,
I think,
a little.
Yeah. So in the, not the, to say that that's all on our shoulders. There's incredible people that do the work of intersectional environmentalism that are predate us. But yeah, so I think it was like an eye to the long game, right? Like, how do we make sure that businesses stay incentivized? Because these really great players that are on the inside of the walls of right now are helping us, but how do we know they're going to stick around? Teams face turnover. People are really heightened and emotional about the issue now from the outside of it. But as people remain on the outside of it, that support will dwindle. And how do we maintain that? So that was also a reaction as well.
And talking recently, you were, you know, how are you thinking about it? And thinking through business models? I know you were mentioning you're thinking through potentially courses or memberships or community or is this something you're thinking personally or as part of your organization? How are you thinking about that?
Both.
Yeah. Okay. Both. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, hearing from the Thinkific experts yesterday and users yesterday was really eye-opening. I think if anybody is, you know, kind of struggling within the context of their own work or within the context of their organization to understand what online resources can do for them, even like more specifically, maybe coursework, the greatest question that was asked yesterday and kind of posed in a lot of different ways was, what do you keep getting asked to offer? Mm-hmm. And I think offerings is just like the most beautiful, like reframing products as offerings is just like the most beautiful mindset shift to me. And what yesterday's event made me think about was how many young people that look like me or have similar backgrounds as me. So like first generation college student, first to move away, first to enter entrepreneurial spaces, first to be in rooms with executives XYZ. Mm-hmm. There is a very, very much so an unspoken language of the professional world, the quote unquote professional world, and what is deemed professional. And I think that navigating that unspoken language is really challenging when you have all of those experiences. And it took me years and years and years to learn how to fit in, but also learn how to be myself within. Mm-hmm. And that is the number one thing that young people ask of me, which is, how do I go from my neighborhood where I'm very accustomed to existing in this way beautifully to being seen just as beautifully in my early entrepreneurial journey, post high school, post college. And so when I think about that personally, I'm like, wow, I feel like I'm having the same phone call over and over and over again. And I'm happy to do it because that's my offering. That's what people see that they can get from me. And I love that. So now I'm like, okay, how do I turn that into a course? So when I think about that in relation to the organization, we are also often answering the same question over and over again, which is, what is intersectional environmentalism and why does it matter?
Right.
So who knows?
So you have two avenues there.
You might see some new coursework from IE. You never know.
Yeah, let us know if we can help. Mm-hmm. Okay, pretty different topic here, but you mentioned capitalism a couple of times. I'm curious how you think about that, especially as well. I mean, there were some interesting things I've heard recently around capitalism as oppression, but also putting the money in the hands of the people who have values. And so how do you, when you think about capitalism, just curious your viewpoints on that. I know it's a big topic, especially as like our organization, we empower entrepreneurs to generate revenue, sharing their knowledge, passion for impact. And so it has positive impact, but there's definitely a huge capitalistic component to it.
Sure. I think that in the context of just my learning journey with the organization, capitalism and more so facing the pressures of it, mm-hmm. as a leader in an organization has taught me so much about reevaluating how to grip and hold hold really tightly systems of reciprocity. Because I think that, and what that actually means. So like one example that I would give is we started to scale our team a little bit, I think like towards the end of the first year, the second year. And we've always had a mix of people who are like Gen Z millennials. So some people who have this really terrible view of what it means to enter the workplace because of millennials. And then millennials who have this really terrible view of the workplace because they've experienced it. And so what is birthed from that is this really rosy view mm-hmm. of what a workplace should be and what it can be if it's run by a bunch of like radical liberals. And so I think what environmentalists, be it that, I'll add.
Right.
So this, I'm a leader of this organization and I have all these people coming in with an extremely rosy view mm-hmm. of them being able to come in and have their dream job.
Mm-hmm.
Pressure.
Right, on you.
A lot of pressure. And I think that it was such a position. I was so grateful for the opportunity to face that tension and ask really good questions like, okay, if I want to the best of my ability, hang on to systems of reciprocity, what does it mean to face really tough questions like, if we are a reciprocal organization, what does it mean to recognize that there's actually not space for this dream role that somebody wants us to have,
mm-hmm.
right? And that, like, we all get to have dream jobs that we want, but is it to the betterment of the organization and the team that is fulfilling roles that are really critical to the organization that we have, is it reciprocal to everyone, including that person that should have the opportunity to go find their dream job, mm-hmm. for me to say, no, you can't continue this role, or this role was temporary and your scope does right. have to come to an end, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to make really tough calls like that.
Yeah.
Even if people in the moment are like, oh, like I didn't like that and it feels oppressive. And I'm like, well, just because you don't like it doesn't make it oppressive.
Right.
But
so what's the example of the role they want? Is that like, I want to come in and just blog about fossil fuels or like,
yeah. I would love that. Yeah. No, I think that happened in a number of ways. Like that's just like a super high level, but I think that happened in a number of ways because when, in the context of where we were at, we were such a young organization, we were really small. And I think that the people that we needed most were people that had complementary skill sets, but still people that were ready and had a capacity to wear a lot of hats. Mm-hmm. And I think that what I would contrast that to is when I first graduated from school, my first job was at Macy's. Shout out to Macy's. I was on the home buying team and I had a great experience. But they're a massive organization and they have mm-hmm. tons of funding mm-hmm. and they really... they understood within the context of their organization that these entry-level folks that they're bringing in, they're investing mm-hmm. a ton of time and energy and mentorship in. So within the context of Macy's, educating people like me coming in, that was built into the budget, that's built into the framework, it's really built in. Yeah. Whereas when you are a tight, small, scrappy, grassroots environmental justice effort, we might not have the funding for you to go hours and hours and hours on educating yourself on how to be.
Right.
Right. Like the people coming to the table are ready. Yeah, no, 100%. Well, we need to get the job done, but I also don't want an environment. I don't want to cultivate an environment where people come in and feel inadequate or inferior to the critical goals that we're facing. Right. And that to me is a disservice to those people. Mm-hmm. So I had to start asking all these really difficult questions around like, okay, I know what this person wants. I know what everybody wants mm-hmm. and everyone is allowed to want what they want.
Yeah.
But how do I, systems of reciprocity is my ultimate goal, how do you synthesize mm-hmm. what everybody wants, what the ultimate goals of the organization are, to a team and basically like a workplace ecosystem mm-hmm. that is properly at all points nourishing and feeding itself. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that you don't even need to be in the room. And that was really, really hard. And I would say that most of my lessons were just like through failures of like
anything
figuring
specific
it out.
You've done to kind of help this work well?
To help it work people. Well? Yeah, yeah. I think that now we have more of a collaborative model, which has really helped. So having a smaller team now that is very well equipped to partner with people that are coming in mm-hmm. with what they're ready to come in for on a project by project basis. Because again, we create educational resources and we help create a lot of really cool programming at the intersection of culture, environment, identity, and being able to work with partners to co-create things mm-hmm. on a project by project basis has given us so much autonomy. It's made us less susceptible to the woes of capitalism because now we have less payroll liability, mm-hmm. which I think is people take for granted. I think that having less payroll liability was so huge because it gave us room to fail. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is like a big, when I think back about horrible workplace experiences that I've had,
yeah.
it's easy when you're younger, when you're newer to the facing that tension to say, oh, my boss was like so mean to me or whatever, right? It's really easy to say, but, and maybe they were, right? Maybe that's valid, but not my boss at Basism. But I think that beyond that, as you go learning about these systems and because systems ultimately create culture, right? So then you start learning more about the systems and you're like, actually, my boss had zero room to fail.
Because of the tight payroll. Because of the... Because they're spending...
Well, because of payroll, because of deadlines, because of all the systems that are like compounding on them.
So you've tried to create systems that create room for failure.
Room for failure, room for learning, room for growth. And I think that's what I learned was I was like, okay, having a smaller team, at least in the context of just where we're at. I'm not saying yeah. small team is the answer. But in the context of what our goals are, how we operate, where we're at... Mm-hmm. We want freedom to say no to projects. Mm-hmm. We want freedom to try new things. Like, we want this freedom. So we need to make sure that we are operating in such a way that creates space for that. And I think that it took me a while to figure out what that should look like. And I think it took us just as a team a while to figure out what that should look like. And that is going to change in the future. But right now, it feels really good.
Yeah. So it sounds like, yeah. you know, strong budgeting and cost control and being conscious of being in a safe place financially gives you that freedom to be more creative, to fail, yeah. to as opposed to being right at the line.
Yeah, no, 100%.
Nothing can go wrong because you're spending everything and you need that next contract or that next partner.
Yeah, 100%.
So how do you think about hiring and like when was the right time to add to the team or hire or I know that especially for a lot of founders and entrepreneurs, that's a big moment, either the first one or how you actually think when mm-hmm. is the right time or for which role or are we ready to bring someone on here? And how much, and I'm assuming in your organization, especially values play a big part in this of, you know.
Yeah. I think generally what we have learned, because at some point you're just throwing money at the problem, right? You're like, oh, we just need to hire that person or
right.
whatever.
Every problem becomes a headcount.
Exactly.
That's the solution to everything.
Yeah, we just need a person to do that. And I think that even though that can be helpful, something that I've learned and that mentors have in one way or another affirmed that we are doing now, which is really important, I think, is when you're a newer organization, is building a lot of intimacy with the issue. So like, again, making sure you have space to fuck up, like you have to make sure you have that space and just like really sitting in that tension of like, this sucks or this isn't working or this, but gaining more of an intimacy with it so that you can go through all of the tools and systems available to help eradicate that issue first. And then if not, leaning on a contractor or a board member or a council member of some sort. And also making sure that you're getting outside perspective to know if the way that you're even scoping out, because the scope should translate to the issue. Mm-hmm. Sorry, the scope should translate to the issue. So, yeah, I think that getting a lot of support and building intimacy with that issue along the way is really, really critical. And in the Sounds beginning, like- we were just throwing money at the problem, right? We were right. like, just hire somebody to do that because we don't want to deal with it. And we were like, no, actually, we... And I think that the reason why, it's not that we didn't want to deal with it. The reason why is we feel like, well, okay. I think the best thing to acknowledge in that is that oftentimes we don't come from backgrounds where you have room to fail.
Right.
So if you feel like you don't know how to immediately fix something, mm-hmm. or if you feel like you don't have the skill set to do so to the point of excellence.
Or even ask for help. Or
yeah, you feel like you can't ask for help or else you'll be perceived as XYZ. What's revealed in that, which is critical in the context of an environmental justice organization, mm-hmm. what's revealed in that is traumas that we all hold about the very, very small margins for error that we see our communities have. And that was another reason why I was like, no, we absolutely need to make sure that we have room for failure and growth because we're investing in ourselves. And so now when I'm not saying hiring is wrong, but now that room, no matter how short or long it may be, that time that we spend facing the different tensions is so sacred to me because that is how our communities grow. And it really affirms that we deserve the space to grow through this issue together. And then if we decide that we need to bring someone on, fine.
Yeah.
But now at least we have this intimacy with the issue and we have affirmed that we get to take up space in learning and growth.
It sounds like hiring is kind of a last resort. Like you're trying everything you can to manage the problem,
yeah,
deal with it with the team you have, mm-hmm, the systems you have, board member, advisor, any other help you can get.
Yeah.
Moving to hiring as a last resort, which mm-hmm means when that person comes in, you know you really needed them in that role. You've tried everything else so they can be more valued, but yeah, also you're creating some room to fail for them. And you understand what they're doing intimately because you've spent so much time as opposed to, seems like there's a problem, let's throw someone at it.
Yeah.
So I love that as sort of taking that all the other steps before you go to actually hiring someone.
Yeah, no, 100%. It is the hard way, but I think it is the necessary way.
Yeah. Well, this has been amazing. I'm just curious, as you look to the future, what are you excited about?
As I look to the future, launching my course, no. I think as I look to the future, I'm really excited to, going back to the intergenerational healing, a lot of the work that I do more creatively, so like poetry and storytelling and things like that, I think that I'm really looking forward to young people continuing to have a healthy sense of skepticism, but really that all of the offerings we create, going back to all products and things that we create, ultimately just being offerings to humanity, come systems that are designed for intergenerational healing. Because there is a huge divide right now. And I think that traditionally we have so many beautiful tools that are designed for intergenerational companionship and healing. So even like thinking about the system of a children's book, like a children's book is designed to be shared between a child and an elder. Mm-hmm. And so how do we reevaluate all of the systems that we operate in, even if it's like the dynamic between a CEO and an intern, mm-hmm, how do we reevaluate systems that lead to intergenerational healing? And I hope that the contrast to that we have felt the past 3 years, mm-hmm, can really help inform how we reshape that in the years to come.
Yeah, well, hey, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. This was awesome.